good evening. Here we are again. And we've started our daily Bible reading schedule again. We've got a new year and we're starting a new schedule. This is great. And the good thing about this, I don't know if you've noticed this, but we started at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis. You can tell it's at the beginning because it says right there on page one, in the beginning. A lot of people think they ought to tackle the Bible just that way. Start at the beginning, read through the middle, and on, you know, get on to the end. It's really difficult to do that. The schedule will help out a little bit, helps us wade through some of the parts that are just a little bit more challenging, shall we say, to us, and help us realize that a little bit from time to time, and we'll work our way all the way through it. Now, let's do a quick poll. This is not to embarrass anybody or to give cause for pride, but let's be honest about this. How many of us actually read through the entire Bible at least one time last year, in the year 2000? You're my heroes. You did so good. I have read some unreliable reports. These are preacher reports. Unreliable reports that suggest that something less than 10% of all people who profess to be believers in Jesus, less than 10% have read the entire Bible in their lifetime. I don't know that that's true or not. Could be true. You never know. There could be a germ of truth in it anyway. Sometimes we look at our culture and we think, was anybody at all interested in God? Are they interested in hearing about God? Interested in knowing God at all? And I think we sometimes presume that people would just not be very interested. But in contrast to those unreliable reports, about 10%, some very reliable reports that I've read suggest that as much as 74% of all the people out here would be interested in hearing from you about God. 74%, 3 out of 4, would be interested in talking to you. They'd be interested in having an invitation from you to come worship with them or whatever. 3 out of 4, who would have thought that? 74%, that's a reliable statistic. Now, the reason it comes to my mind is that we read a story a couple of weeks ago, actually, because I'm a little bit cheating on this daily Bible reading thing for this week. We need to go back to Genesis chapter 20. If you want to go back to Genesis chapter 20, we're going to take a look at that chapter because here, Abraham found faith in God, found some interest in God in a very unexpected place. He did not think that he would run into somebody who cared about God here. And while we're turning to Genesis chapter 20, I want to recap just a few items out of Abraham's life, kind of pull us up to speed, let us know where we are. By this time, by the time we get to Genesis chapter 20, God has spoken to Abraham 5 times. He's spoken to Abraham 5 times. And in the chapter immediately before this, he had just told Abraham, I'm going to be back in a year and your wife Sarah is going to have a child. Now, the initial promise was 24 years earlier, but just a little bit earlier, God had said, I'm going to be back in a year, and your wife, Sarah, is going to have a child. Okay? Great. So, in this stunning failure of trust, immediately after that, Abraham palms his wife, Sarah, off on a king named Abimelech, you know, the king of Gerar. Well, the name, by the way, Abimelech means father king. He's the father king. Well, Abraham's name means father of a multitude. And the multitude is going to come from Isaac, who has not showed up yet. So anyway, I mean, it gets kind of crazy here. But I want to look at the story, and I want you to watch for religious faith in God from a Gentile. And like Abraham, we would not have suspected. We would have guessed that this man is a pagan with little or no interest whatever in serving God or knowing about God. But the truth of the matter is, we may find some religious faith in highly unexpected places. We might be really surprised where we hear from people who have an interest in God. Let's start reading in Genesis chapter 20, and I want to just talk about this story here in Genesis chapter 20. Now, Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev, that's down the southern part of Israel, lived between Kadesh and Shur. For a while, he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, she's my sister. Now, he'd already pulled this stunt once with Pharaoh, and it worked, so he's going to do it again. She's my sister. Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, you are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She's a married woman. Now, Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, she's my sister? And didn't she also say, he's my brother? I've done this with a clear conscience and clean hands. Then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience, and so I've kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all yours will die. Okay. Wow. What a beginning to the story. Abimelech takes Sarah. I guess she was a real babe. She's 89 years old here. Okay, look, it's not really about looks and attraction. This is a peace treaty. When Abimelech takes this woman, he is making an alliance, he thinks, with Abraham, because Abraham is a guy to be reckoned with. Let's face facts. This guy's got 318 trained men in his household. He can field a small army. There are probably 1,000 people total in Abraham's retinue there. This guy is a force to be reckoned with. And Abimelech is thinking to himself, I'll make a treaty with him and everything will be fine. So he's taken Sarah to be his wife. She's really a peace treaty with a very powerful nomad named Abraham. So here he is, he's taken this woman, and as he's dreaming, and he has this dream, and God says, you're as good as dead. But the amazing thing is that Abimelech replied to him and said, Lord. Abimelech called God Lord from the very beginning. He knew something about God, enough to know that he's dealing with deity here. Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? It's not my fault. She said, I'm his sister and he's my brother. And that's what he said. And this is not my fault. And the amazing thing about this is when his fault is pointed out to him, when Abimelech knows the problem, he obeys God. He's gonna stay with God, going to do God's will. So look at verse 8 with me. We'll just continue this on. Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. There is some fear of God here. That's amazing. There's some fear of God. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You've done things to me that should not be done. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what was your reason for doing this? Now, Abimelech is going to obey God. And all the officials are shaken by this too. This is crazy. This doesn't make sense. What's happened to us? We've got God mad at us. We don't want that. This is a losing proposition. What's astonishing here is that Abimelech has a very strong moral sense. Did you hear the moral language in here? You brought great guilt upon me. That's a moral statement. You brought great guilt upon me. You have done things that should not be done. That's a moral statement. There's right and there's wrong. You've done wrong and you made me do wrong. And then he says something that I really think is fascinating. The NIV has kind of weakened this, I'm afraid. I didn't check other versions on this. In verse 10, he says, what was your reason for doing this? Literally in the Hebrew, Abimelech says, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? What was going on in your mind that you thought this was a good idea? What were you thinking? And Abraham replies to him here, starting in verse 11. Abraham replied, I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place. And they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother. And she became my wife. And let me just insert right here that is not justification for what he did. You know, the reality that she is kind of his half-sister, that doesn't cut it. Okay, this is a feeble sort of excuse. When God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, this is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. I have this premeditated sin in mind, and now I've enlisted a co-conspirator to help me out in this. I want you to lie just like I lie, okay? Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, my land is before you, live wherever you like. To Sarah, he said, I'm giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. This is to cover the offense against you before all who are with you. You are completely vindicated. Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girl, so they could have children again, for the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah. What were you thinking? And Abraham's reply is, I didn't think that there'd be any fear of God here. I thought there'd be no fear of God. And Abraham knew that if there's no fear of God, if there's no interest in God, there's no moral sense. They'll kill him and not care. There has to be a fear of God in order for us to have any kind of moral sense about us. And then Abimelech winds up deferring to God's man. Hey, he's a prophet. This is God's man. We got to step back and do the right thing here. So he defers to God's man, gives him money, gives him freedom. Live anywhere you want to. You are completely innocent in this. You are absolutely vindicated. You're the good guys. I'm the bad guy. Everything's go. Everything's fine from now on. And Abraham, I think, is surprised here to discover that Abimelech expected a pagan. But Abimelech has faith in God. We didn't expect that. We're kind of surprised to discover that too, aren't we? Abimelech has some faith in God. That's really odd. And yet, throughout the Bible, we see some kind of unexpected faith in God. Did you know we've already run into a guy that, on the surface, if we didn't already know something about this, it would surprise us, and it was supposed to surprise us when we read about a guy named Melchizedek. You remember Melchizedek? He's the guy who runs out to meet Abraham after the big defeat of the kings, and Abraham is successful in retrieving Lot and all those people, brings them back, and Melchizedek is the king of Salem, the town that finally becomes Jerusalem. And Melchizedek goes out because he is priest of God Most High. Where did that come from? His faith in God. He's priest of God Most High. That's pretty amazing. One of our favorite stories in the Old Testament is about pagans having faith in God when they weren't supposed to. That's Jonah. Jonah goes to Nineveh, preaches to the city of Nineveh, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. He gets 120,000 responses. 120,000 people repent. He's mad about it. We didn't expect that they'd be interested in serving and pleasing God. Man, those people locked right up. And there's another very obscure character in the Bible, but very powerful character in world history named Cyrus. We call him Cyrus the Great or Cyrus the Persian. He's predicted by name in Isaiah. And because he's predicted by name, when he took over the Babylonian Empire, the Jews could hold up the scrolls and say, we've been expecting you. And Cyrus had respect for God and turned the Jews loose and sent them home from the Babylonian captivity. We didn't expect religious faith in this guy. We didn't expect him to have respect for God, but he did. We find faith in the most unexpected places. And you know, it's not just in the Old Testament. It happens in the New Testament, too. I want you to go to the book of Matthew with me. We're going to take a look at a couple of passages in Matthew and finally one in Acts. And I want to start with a story in Matthew chapter 8. In verse 5, right after the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 8 and verse 5, Jesus comes home to Capernaum, and we'll just read the story. Start with me in Matthew 8 and verse 5 and read about some unexpected faith. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him. Centurion, that's a Roman soldier, or at least a soldier in the service of Rome. He may not be a Roman citizen, but he's powerful, and he's a Gentile. He's not a Jew. He's a centurion. asking for help. Lord, he said, Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. Jesus said to him, I'll go and heal him. The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. Now, if you skip over to Luke chapter 7 and read the similar account as Luke tells it, this guy, this centurion, has some Jews that jump up and say, wait a minute now, he deserves for you to do this because this is a good man. He loves our nation. He's built our synagogue. He's taken good care of us. This guy has some faith in God. He's a Gentile, but he has faith in God. He says, just say the word, my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this. He does it. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. People are supposed to know God don't have faith like that. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west, will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said to the centurion, go, it'll be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that very hour. Here's a pagan. Well, he's not a pagan. He's a worshiper of God. He's just not a Jew. But he has respect for God. He's interested in God, interested in hearing about God, interested in knowing God, and interested in serving Jesus. Skip over to chapter 15. I'll show you another one. Chapter 15, Jesus is traveling, and he goes way up north. He's completely out of Galilee. He's going through Judea, completely out of Galilee. He's way up there in the Phoenician area, what's now Lebanon, in the area of Tyre and Sidon. Matthew 15, starting in verse 21, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, a Canaanite woman. Now, you are supposed to bristle. If you're a Jew reading this, you're supposed to just bristle at the idea of the Canaanites. Well, the Canaanites were the ones we were supposed to exterminate when we took over the promised land. They're judged by God. They're terrible, terrible people. And so a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, Lord, Lord, Son of David. She's calling him Messiah. And he knows it. Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter's suffering terribly from demon possession. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. He answered, I will send only to the lost sheep of Israel. The woman came and knelt before him. Lord, help me, she said. Lord, help me. He replied, it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Now, this sounds so insulting to us. It really isn't insulting. What Jesus is saying is, this saving message was prepared specifically for the people of Israel. It's not right. It's not right to take what was prepared for the people of Israel and just send it willy-nilly everywhere else. Yes, Lord, she said, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. She says, I'm not asking you to take one thing away from the people of Israel. I'm not asking you for anything like that. All I want is what they don't want. All I want is what they've already set aside and rejected. And Jesus answered, woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted, and her daughter was healed from that very hour. This is a woman who has some faith in God, some faith in Jesus. We didn't expect that. He's in the Canaanite realm. He's up there in Tyre and Sidon. What are these people doing? I want to show you one more just to demonstrate that this happens. There are people that we would not expect to have respect for God, certainly wouldn't expect to have respect for Jesus. Skip over to Acts chapter 18. Paul's going on these missionary journeys, and he's had some success, had some rejection. Things are going well. Things are not going so well. He winds up in Corinth. Corinth, oh no, arguably one of the most wicked cities in the ancient world. Oh my, you don't want to be there. You don't want to be there. And so he starts preaching here in Corinth. And watch what happens there. There's some very interesting kind of throwaway statements here. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. He wasn't having very much success in Athens. A little bit, not much. There he met a Jew in Corinth, a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. We know from secular history that happened in the year 49. AD 49, Jews are expelled from Rome. Paul went to see them because he was a tent maker as they were. He stayed and worked with them every Sabbath. He reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Now, do you catch this so far? He's hanging out with Priscilla and Aquila, who are Jews. He's going to the synagogue, to the Jews, and the God-fearers, the people who are already there, Jews and Greeks, who are already listening. They have some respect for God. They're listening to God. Those are exactly the people you'd think would listen to the gospel message. All right? When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I'm clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he did. Then Paul left the synagogue, went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his entire household believed in the Lord, and many of the Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. But then now, see, he's branched way out beyond the Jews, who are having a lot of trouble with this message, and they don't particularly like it. But when Paul says, "I go to the Gentiles," he begins to have stunning success. There is some measure of faith in God there. There are some people who know some things about God. But you know, God's love has always been bigger than just one nation. It's always been true. Jesus said, "I have sheep that are not of this sheepfold," talking to the Jews. "I have other sheep you guys don't know anything about." And God really is at work in some surprising ways. I'm just point this out to you, and as I say this, you're going to recognize that this is absolutely true. We got some neighbors around us that have some very strong ethics. They have a sense of right and wrong. We don't know what they know about God, but they have a sense of right and wrong. And there are things that should be done and things that should not be done. I read an essay not very long ago by a guy named Robert Ovi. And he was talking about the politically correct movement, about, you know, being completely inoffensive to anybody and not using any harsh language or anything like that. And we laugh about some of the excesses of this politically correct movement. And he says they're worth laughing at. But the thing for you to remember is that that whole idea of being tolerant, that's Christian. That's Christian ethics at work. You know, the whole idea of being inoffensive, that's Christian. And so this whole politically correct movement has really come out of Christian ethics and morals. There are a lot of people around us that feel very, very strongly about right and wrong. And these standards of right and wrong come from God. They don't come from pagan religions, Eastern religions, anything like that. They come from God. So people who have a belief in God have some right sense of right and wrong. We don't know how much they might know about God. We don't know how deeply they might love God. But if they have a sense of right and wrong, they're already interested somehow in knowing about God. So we got some neighbors that have some really strong ethics. We've also got some neighbors who have a pretty sincere belief in Jesus. We recognize that we've got lots of other religious groups in town, denominational groups that claim allegiance from a lot of people. And we have a lot of theological disagreements with them, think they missed the boat in a lot of ways. And in the not-too-distant future, I'm going to talk pretty pointedly on a Sunday morning about the problem with the whole denominational idea. Denominationalism is a sin against God. The idea of having denominations in the church is a sin against God in itself. And I'm going to have to talk about that. We don't bring that up very often. But people out here who are worshiping with denominational groups very often have a deep and sincere faith in Jesus. And sometimes they really surprise us with some of their insights. I don't know if you're aware of this. The New York Times has a bestseller list, and they publish that each week, best-selling books. As a matter of policy, the New York Times has never included religious books on their bestsellers list. So you're never going to find a religious book on a bestseller list from the New York Times. And that leads some people to conclude that religious books don't sell very well. That's not true. In 2008, the only year that I was able to find out any information, 2008, there were almost a billion religious books sold in the United States of America. That's pretty good. That represents a lot of money. Something on the order of $27 billion in Christian publishing, so-called Christian publishing. That doesn't include Bible sales, because if you were going to add the Bible sales, the Bible is the number one best-selling book of all time by a very wide margin. You know, it's number one right about here. Number two is just off the carpet. You know, number one is way up here. It outsells every book by a very, very wide margin. They don't tell you that. They don't tell you. Who's buying the Bibles? Who are reading those Bibles? Well, people who are developing some faith. And they may not know the gospel. They may not know accurately how to become disciples of Jesus, but they want to be disciples. There's some interest there. These people are interested in hearing about God. So we've got some neighbors who have a sincere belief in Jesus, and we have some neighbors who have a very strong religious background. There's a guy named Tom Rainer who's done some great research on unchurched people who are now in churches. And what he said is, just because somebody is unchurched, that does not mean they never go to church. They often do go to church, and many of them have a history in their background of attendance at various churches. And all of that has an impact in them. I've told you my story lots of times. You've heard this. I don't want to bore you with it again. I just want to remind you that when I was growing up, we didn't go to church very much. When we did, we went a lot of different places. I've been to Lutheran, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, different kinds of Baptists, American Baptists, Southern Baptists. I've gone to all kinds of different churches. And all of that had an impact in me. Somewhere, you know, they may not have got it right, but somewhere they taught me something about Jesus. And somewhere they taught me something about loving God. And when somebody came to me with the gospel message, I was at least able to hear it. Because I'd heard some things before. So none of that is wasted or lost motion. There are some unlikely people in your network of friends, relatives, associates, who have a very strong religious heritage. And I think sometimes we approach our whole world kind of like Abraham approached the kingdom of Gerar. Abraham is going into the kingdom of Gerar, and he thinks that he's a stranger, a fearful stranger in a foreign land where nobody respects God and his life is just hanging by a thread. There are all these hostile people on all sides. And we might actually develop that idea in our minds that there's no fear of God, there's no interest in God in this place. That's not true. It's not true. All experience and all research shows that that's not true. What would happen if we just presumed? What if you just made the assumption that everybody you meet is going to be interested in talking about God with you? Everybody you run into knows something about Jesus and is willing to talk about Jesus. How would we change in our approach to our neighbors and our friends and the people that we deal with every day if we just presumed that they were interested in knowing Jesus? There's an old preacher story, you know. I like the preacher stories because they don't have to be true. You make the point even if it's a big fat lie. All right, this is a preacher story. There's a story about an Indian man, American Indian, who's visiting a friend of his in New York City. And they're walking down the street and the Indian fellow stops his buddy and says, "Hey, can you hear that?" And the guy says, "Hear what?" He says, "That cricket. You hear that cricket?" He says, "Cricket? You are crazy. You're in the middle of New York City. There aren't any crickets around." He says, "No, there's a cricket. You can't hear that cricket?" And he looks around, he sees a planter over there by a sidewalk restaurant, goes over there and listens and starts digging around in the dirt and comes up with a cricket. He's holding a cricket. And the guy says, "How in the world did you hear a cricket in the middle of the traffic jams and all the hubbub and buzz that's going on around here? How did you do that?" And the Indian man says, "Oh, you know, you just hear what you're listening for. That's true of everybody. You always hear what you're listening for." Stuck his hand in his pocket, pulled out a handful of change. He says, "Watch this." And he just dropped it on the sidewalk. And when those coins hit the sidewalk and started bouncing and jingling, every head for 20 yards turned and looked. He says, "You hear what you're listening for. You hear what you're listening for." I think that's probably pretty true. Whether the story is true or not, I think the point is true. I think we're going to find what we look for. If we go out looking for people who are hostile to us, we'll probably find some. But I think if we go out looking for people who are interested in God and just interested in hearing about Jesus, I kind of confidently expect that the reliable research is right. About 3 out of 4 people you run into will be interested in talking about Jesus and knowing about Jesus. How would our lives change if we just expected that people would be interested in God? And more importantly, how would our lives change if we just acted on our own interest in God? We're going to sing an invitation song and give you an opportunity to act. If you're not a Christian, but you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, you've heard this, and you know He's the Son of God, and you're convinced that you need to repent of your sins, and you understand that you're willing to confess His name before men, and you're willing to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. You've read that. You know it. Now you're ready to act. You can do that. We're going to sing a song and give you an opportunity to do that. You can be immersed in water tonight for the forgiveness of your sins and raised to a new life. And if you're a Christian, you've made the covenant with Christ in the past, but you've always kind of felt like a fearful stranger in a hostile land, you need to get some more confidence, I think, and recognize that there's faith out here. There's faith in unexpected places, and there are people who are willing to listen and hear from us about Jesus. And that's a good thing, too. If you need to respond publicly to the invitation of Jesus Christ, we urge you to do it right now while we stand and sing the song.